Okay, I'm going to talk about an approach. So Joan mentioned the problem of coalescing binary black hole systems, and I'm going to talk about a modeling approach to this problem. Most of the work I'm going to talk about is the results I'll talk about are produced by Lazarus Research Group, which includes Manuela Campanelli, Carlos Lusto, and a student, Enrique Pasos, University of Texas Brown, so myself, and Ryoji Takahashi in Copenhagen. I started out also from, I guess, the same Lisa-centric point of view that Joan was mentioning. Maybe it's something at Goddard, but one possible source of binary black hole gravitational waves is supermassive black hole coalescences, which are a result of galactic merger. So I should mention it's not the only kind of black hole waves. We also expect the possibility of binary black hole mergers of black holes of more stellar scale black hole, and there may be some simulations suggest that those are generated by the dynamics of globular clusters and or possibly the result of the evolution of a binary system of ordinary stars. But I'll go back to my demonstration mentioning the LISA case of interest, which is we have it seems to be the case that most galaxies have supermassive black holes, meaning black holes on the order of 10 to the 6 solar masses or larger at their cores, and there seems it's shown in simulations, and there are optical observations of things that look like galaxy mergers, so galaxies seem to merge, and then the question is, do the black holes merge as well? It may be the case that inside the center of this newly formed galaxy from a merger, there's two black holes, and it seems likely that processes of dynamical friction and multi-body interactions will eventually bring the black holes close enough together so that gravitational radiation is sufficient to force them into a tighter and tighter binary until at some point at the very end there's a burst of radiation that we might be able to detect, and that's the kind of thing we're trying to model. This is a little movie of some of our results, but we're in this particular project interested not in this stuff that we heard about in the last talk, but which last talk really pertained directly mostly to the earlier in spiral part of the waveforms. So what do the waveforms look like? Here we have for sufficiently far apart systems that aren't moving too fast, we have post-Newtonian type techniques that can give us an accurate picture of the waveforms, and eventually we have close limit models. And we're interested in constraining the imagination about what might be going on in the middle here. And so we're trying to make the best application of existing numerical relativity technology together with other approximation theories in order to get some results for binary black hole systems. And that's what we call the Lazarus Project. But so this is a little map of how we view the binary black hole modeling problem. We have various, on this side, various theoretical techniques at our disposal that we want to use, and we're also keeping in mind what's going on with observation. Numerical simulations is the centerpiece of the problem, and I shouldn't say too much about the generalities of numerical relativity. A lot of people are experts in that here. Let me just mention that there are many outstanding issues in numerical relativity that haven't been solved. Here we're trying to solve systems of coupled nonlinear PDEs, and we have gauge issues that we have to resolve. We have to choose appropriate gauges. We have boundary conditions that we haven't completely figured out what we should be doing. We have formulations that don't seem to be completely stable, and we're, for the most case, people are working with unconstrained evolutions, which means if the constraints should begin to be violated, that they continue to be violated, and they tend to grow exponentially, which is an unfortunate problem. On the other hand, our group is not focusing on solving these problems at the moment, but taking what's been developed to this point and trying to apply it in some way to get some results that constrain the imagination for what's happening in these binary black hole mergers. And we're depending also on a lot of other preparation, the existence of specialized software platforms that make the development of numerical codes easy, Cactus and Paramesh, which is used at Goddard for adaptive mesh refinement. And our goal is to make the best application with the existing technology. There are also special problems. These are general issues of numerical relativity, but special problems for binary black holes. We have to come up with some model for the initial values with which to start numerical simulations, which I'll talk about. We call that the far limit modeling. And we have problems that in general have ranges of space-time scales. We have to do a good job very close to the black holes, and yet the orbital time scale, if you want to reach out for orbits, is much longer than that. We have singularities, which we have to handle by excision or punctures. And through all of this, oh dear, what is that mean? Okay. Through all of this, we're limited to a very brief amount of numerical simulation that we can do before inaccuracies become too much for us. And of course, we're doing this on supercomputers. Our far limit methods, here's what we need to provide some initial configuration of black holes that we're going to treat with numerical simulations. And we heard in the last talk about post-Newtonian, post-Minkowskian type approximations, which are appropriate for slowly moving particles and very good for giving us waveforms for the early in-spiral dynamics of binary black hole systems, but not so good for the strong fields that are very close to the black holes, which are critical for us when we want to do numerical simulations. And so we look in other directions for models for black holes that are still already quite close together, but not yet a single black hole. Here we're looking toward families of solutions to the constraint problem that can be concocted into kinematical models. And from these, to do this, you have to make some choices about not only what you believe the astrophysical scenario is, but your theoretical prejudice as to what you think the data look like. And if you can construct this kind of kinematical model, you can talk about things as what are circular. You can try to define circular orbits even though you don't have dynamics. And in particular, we don't make an attempt at this point to have initial radiation content in this. So all the historical radiation is generated and any immediate radiation reaction to it is missing from the model. There's a lot of development going on in this area, and we're using a fairly standard family of data in numerical relativity. But in the future, I expect other ideas are going to be important, and there's a lot of room for creativity here. In the end, we have another approximation technique, which is close-limit black hole perturbation theory. A single black hole forms. It forms initially with some distortions. The distortions create ringing, and all through this process, radiation is driven away from the strong field region and out. What's nice about this is it reduces the problem to a 2 plus 1 linear wave equation, which can be easily solved. And it's been demonstrated to work quite well in many cases for this final ringing radiation and the propagation away to where it can be observed of any radiation that was generated earlier. We like to keep in mind, to some extent, the realities of the observation. Just to mention that LIGO has actually just gone through its second science run, and bursts of radiation, as might be generated by binary black holes, are already being searched for. So far, the search techniques are based on unmodeled search, and we want to advance that to the possibility of having some model information going into the searches. And this is part of the goal of the KUDU project, which includes the Lazarus Project people, together with Warren Anderson, Charlie Torres, a student at the University of Texas Brownsville, and Julian Creighton. And the goal here is to look for robust features in the binary black hole burst model results, features that seem to be robust from different configurations of black holes and different approximation techniques, and not only the Lazarus Project techniques necessarily. And if you can find some robust features, then they allow you to distinguish between a binary black hole gravitational wave event and some other noise event, because quite frankly, if you're only looking for ring downs, a lot of things look like ring downs that aren't necessarily binary black holes. And so hopefully we can find something that's useful to key on that can be developed into a detection type data analysis algorithm. In a LISA case, binary black holes are a part of the science goals of the LISA project. They may have very relatively large signals. And so that depending on what the event rates are like, which as Joan mentioned, it's not completely clear, But it may be necessary to subtract some of these larger supermassive binary black hole coalescence signals in some way from the data in order to be able to see more sensitive things at the same frequency range, like the captures of smaller objects by a supermassive black hole. It may be a problem, it may not be a problem. One thing about the LISA project is some people at NASA aren't going to consider the LISA project a success until the information that comes out of it has actually been translated into astrophysical interpretations rather than just a raw data stream. And so part of the technology development, which is regarded as necessary, is actually theoretical development in knowing something about what kind of waveform sources you're looking for. And so theoretical people are actually plugged into the project includes space and demands that certain theoretical targets be met in order to consider the project as going on target. That's just a mention. So from our point of view, putting all these things together is how we define our job as trying to do binary black hole modeling. And now let me try to get into a little more detail. I showed you the Hipthorne waveform, and people talk about the in-spiral period and the numerical relativity part and the ring down part, but we like to look at a space-time type of model. So this is a binary black hole space-time. You start with two separates, a cartoon, two separated black holes, and as time goes forward up, then the black holes get closer and closer together and form a ringing black hole in the end, and all the while radiation is going away towards some observers, which is LISA because of my LISA-centric point of view. And so we're going to divide this into regions and treat the different regions by different approximation techniques. We have eventually, when it's a single black hole, close limit approximation technique, which is black hole perturbation theory. Here in the middle, we're going to use a full numerical simulation, numerical methods. And we need some far limit model, which is going to be a kinematical model based on solutions to constraint equations. And the first problem I want to consider, is the coalescence of black holes of equal mass non-spinning black holes. So two black holes with equal masses that are non-spinning, and they're starting out somewhere close to the ISCO region, which means the last stable orbit, if there is such a thing, as is identified through this family of initial data, the kinematical structure of it. And we're in fact going to, this is a family of circular type orbits for, we're looking at Bowen-York puncture type data for those who are familiar with the varieties. And we're going to be looking at just these closest few cases. So our black holes start out from 4.9 to I think 7.8 m apart, depending on which case we look at. And a typical example of we use this as initial data. And then we take this data, we send it into numerical code. Our numerical code is based on the ADM equations, the oldest fashioned system of evolution equations, because we find that for this brief time of evolution, they still seem to be the most accurate. This may not continue to be true forever, but at the time we started this work, it seemed to be the case. And our numerical simulation, we try to push out the outer boundary, still relatively close in, but far enough so that the future of the boundary, we can ignore it in our data and essentially excise the region near the boundary so that we don't have to solve the sensitive boundary modeling problem, which is another issue. And but we are limited in spatial extent. We use a coordinate mapping to push the boundary out without suffering from losing resolution in the interior. And we're limited to less than, say, 15 m of time evolution here, 15 times the mass of the system in geometric units. And this is not too much, but at this point, from these cases, we seem to be able to get something, a single black hole seems to be forming, and then we identify what that background black hole is and reinterpret the space-time at that point as perturbations of that black hole, pass data to a close-limit black hole perturbation theory result, and drive any radiation generated out to an observer that's far away in a radiation zone, and get waveforms like this. This is a waveform for one of these cases of near ISCO black holes. So this is radiation representing the final plunge of the black holes together. These are the two polarizations of it. And for the equal mass non-spinning binary black hole case, let me just draw only one thing to your attention here, which is, well, that the two polarizations seem to have a relationship to each other, being roughly 90 degrees out of phase, and that's an interesting effect. But I'm going to talk about this more in a minute. What we're interested in, we get the waveform, but then we have to ask some questions about did we do this right? And we have this model, and there are sources of error everywhere. So we have error in putting the initial data together. We have error in the numerical simulation. We have error in the linear approach to the rest of the evolution. And we have to come up with some way to assess this. And one of the nice things about our Lazarus approach is that we have a kind of internal way to ask these kind of questions, which is if since we have multiple different independent techniques for doing the calculation, if we trade one with the other and see if we get the same result, then we're happy and we feel good about the level of error. So we do things like this, sort of exchange the boundary between these two domains in our cartoon space-time picture here. And this amounts to starting with black holes that are farther and farther apart before we send them into numerical simulation. And if the waveforms don't depend too much on that, then we feel good about the fact that this part of the model wasn't subject to too much error. We also do the same thing up here. And there are many details about this interface, which some of you have probably heard about in other talks, but I'm not going to get into too much detail about that. Now, so in this case, for these waveforms, the interesting question is, if we start with black holes that are in different positions, also on circular orbits, do we get different waveforms out as a result, or are they nearly the same? And what we observe is, at least within the 20% or so level that we even look at these waveforms, the waveforms are quite similar. They lie mostly on top of each other, even though we started with black holes that are 8m apart instead of 4m apart. We also know these waveforms have been shifted in time by each waveform on top of each other. So let me say what this is. QC0 is the closest case, and QC4, this is 4.9m apart initially. This is 7.8m apart initially. And we've shifted them in time because it takes a little while longer for the waves to come out from the cases that started a little farther apart. An interesting point is it doesn't take that much longer, even though they're 4.9 up to 3m farther apart. It only takes really a few m to reach the same stage in this waveform. So there's a lot of indication that even for cases that are allegedly pre-ISCO, and from the information we get from the kinematical model, the collapse is really quite rapid, and nothing happens on a timescale that seems like an orbital timescale. On the other hand, the waveforms still come out really quite similar to each other, so we feel good that we're not suffering, the result isn't suffering too much, does not seem so far to be suffering too much from effects of this initial data. So just to summarize some of the results, we see this rapid type of plunge in these cases. We see some independence of the results on the initial data, so that's some support for our simple kinematical far limit model. And I mentioned that there's a phase relation between the plus and cross polarizations, and this is really a circular polarization pattern. If you're an observer on the system's rotational axis and you're looking, you'll see radiation that's largely circularly polarized, and that's what the signature of that is, that offset in the phase relationship between the two components of radiation. And this is the same radiation pattern that you expect for a rotating body, to a body that's generating gravitational radiation through its rotational motion, as opposed to other kinds of motions, which certainly there are other kinds of motions in the radial motion of the black holes, but the part generating the radiation consistently anyway seems to be the rotation. And just to get some picture of this polarization, we look at the two polarizations of the waveform. We have a plus and cross polarization, which in our model are the real and imaginary parts of a complex wave function. And so we can look at that complex wave function in terms of a amplitude and a phase. And the phase is the polarization angle of the radiation that's going out along the system's axis. And the amplitude is the polarization amplitude of that circularly polarized piece. If the radiation is genuinely circularly polarized, then you won't see any variation in the amplitude, the polarization amplitude, on the time scale of the frequency of the radiation. If it was plane polarized, this would be going to zero at every node in the waveform. And what you actually see is that after we shift these in time, they line up reasonably well on top of each other for all of these cases, even though we started the black holes somewhat farther apart in different cases. And except for there's some notable stuff in the beginning that's not so much dominated by the circular polarized part. If we if we shift the time of these so that the initial data is this, the time at which we impose the initial data from the far limit model is time zero by definition in these pictures in all cases, then these thing there's a coherence in this non-circular polarized junk that we see. So that suggests to us that these non-circular polarized parts in the beginning here are consequence something of the initial model, the initial data model, that is actually non-physical in a sense. It's something coming from the initial data that we wouldn't really like. And we're happy to see that as we begin with black holes farther apart, this stuff actually seems to be getting smaller. So the amplitude of this non-circular polarized part is getting smaller when we start the black holes farther apart, which is consistent because we expect the modeling problem to be the initial data modeling problem to be easier for black holes that are farther apart. So we're happy to see that. This is an independent picture. These two are completely independent from each other. This is the phase, and we also see the polarization angle rather is constant in this early part. This is some junk that is linearly polarized, and then around 4 dm, which is near where the waves from the strong field region start to reach our observers, the polarization angle increases steadily, and that's a sign of circular polarization. For circular polarized wave, we can calculate an instantaneous frequency, which is the rate at which this polarization angle changes, and we look at that for all these cases, and the oscillations in this are the piece that's not circularly polarized. But what we see, if you try to look at the picture of this, what's happening to this, this instantaneous frequency is the slope of this curve. So we see the frequency is increasing in all cases, taking a little longer. These have been normalized by the quasi-normal ring down frequency, so they approach 1 as we get to the ring down. And over here, later, the waves are getting very small. It's hard to do anything right. But we see, in general, frequency sweeping up to the ring down frequency and taking a little longer to do so for the cases that start farther apart. In the beginning, it's affected quite strongly by non-circular polarized part, but later, not so much. So let me also, in this process, 2.5% of the system's energy, roughly, is radiate lost in energy, and that's lost to this gravitational radiation after this ISCO plunge, according to these calculations. And that's somewhat comparable to the historical radiation, which I don't have a figure for, up to that point through the in-spiral process. So it's quite a significant amount of energy lost. Because of the pattern in the waveforms, we can make a simple fit to it. And this is essentially fitting a waveform that has this increasing sweep of polarization, purely circularly polarized wave with increasing sweep of frequency and of this instantaneous frequency and a peak-shaped amplitude, which we made a 6-parameter model of or something. You can get a pretty good fit to what the waveforms look like, which allow us to say something about something simple about what the waveforms are like and maybe useful. But now let's move on to some other cases. And the next case we're going to look at is spinning black holes. Again, we start with a similar family of we're using the same initial data model to begin with here, the puncture, Bowen-York puncture type of data. And this time we're just going to start with spinning black holes at the ISCO. And even though these data are actually don't have the limit we'd like to see for large spins, even a single Bowen-York spinning puncture black hole isn't exactly a Kerr black hole, but it's a distorted Kerr black hole and it'll produce some radiation. The radiation that it will produce is far smaller than the radiation we're looking at in these cases, so we're not too concerned about this, and we're also limited to we're also sticking to the case of fairly moderate spins, spin parameters on the initial black hole, so we don't expect that to be a problem for us, the biggest problem of our model. Our spins are either exactly aligned or counter-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, so there's still a well-defined axis, and there won't be any precessional effects. We don't want to see the precessional effects. They'll complicate it too much. We won't be able to understand what's going on. So this is the best place for us to start. And we're going to see, we want to see how the waveforms are affected by spins other than precessionally. And we're using these fisheye coordinates, which allow us to move the boundary of the numerical simulations far away without actually decreasing the resolution in the strong field region. Our evolutions are ADM system again, with maximal slicing and shift equals zero, and the simulations are limited to t less than 15m, and we see essentially a marginal linearization in all these cases. And let me give you a kind of clue, a little illustration of that. This is for this case of, so I should have pointed out that the, let me take a step back. This is the initial cartoon of the initial positions and spins of all these cases. For cases where the spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum, then the spin-orbit coupling is repulsive and it pushes the ISCO in closer together. And for the other cases, the ISCO's opposite case, the ISCO's farther out. So if we look at the closest case, we're actually able to evolve long enough that we can numerically find an apparent horizon forming around the black holes. And so that's interesting for us because it allows us to take a look when we're passing the information through to the close limit approximation. Remember I said we have to find a background black hole and identify perturbations of it that you're going to use for the propagating the radiation away. And so we identify this background black hole completely independently of how we find the apparent horizons in the numerical simulation. And it's interesting to compare the two here. After 11M, we haven't formed an apparent horizon yet, but the dotted line is where our calculations suggest the background black hole, it's by definition circular, is in this slice of the space. And at, after 12M, we see now an apparent horizon forming, and it's somewhere in the vicinity of our dotted line. And if we go a few M farther, just before our numerical simulation is starting to fail quite troublingly, then the apparent horizon is circularizing and starting to look more like our background horizon definition. So we feel pretty good. This is just another piece of support. We have other ways that we're judging our identification of the background black hole, but this is something new that we're happy about. Now let me talk about these results for the spinning black hole cases. Again, we see the same simple-looking form for the waveforms. There's not a dramatic effect of spin, and that's quite consistent with what we're seeing in an effective one-body approach to spinning waveforms and things as well. That the spin doesn't produce a dramatic effect. And in post-Newtonian calculations, there's some degeneracy between the effect of spin and the effect of changing the masses. And so it's probably not too much of a shock, but nice to see that we're actually getting the same result, and serving to constrain imagination as our goal is. And so let me show you waveforms. It's interesting that if we take, I'm not showing you the individual waveforms for these, we have five different cases of spin, including those aligned and anti-aligned with two each aligned, one with zero spin and two anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And these numbers are roughly the A over M for the individual black holes here. And the waveforms don't look identical to each other, but if you rescale time in these waveforms by the quasi-normal reading frequency time scale, then the waveforms seem to lie quite well on top of each other. And that suggests that there's, again, some kind of a degeneracy in the dependence of spin, the waveforms on the spin. At least this is a preliminary indication of that. And that may be useful. We may be able to make use out of that and look in searching for these kind of bursts that there's not as much variety as there could be. Though of course, we haven't considered precessional effects at all. Again, we see a circular polarization pattern, and so we can calculate an instantaneous frequency, and the curves look something similar to what they did before. Let me not talk too much about that. The energy now, 2 to 2.5% of the system's energy is radiated away in the final part of the in this final plunge of the two black holes together, and it's comparable, though actually in some cases a little bit less than it was for the non-spinning case. And an interesting question to ask, now that we're putting spins on the black hole, is what is the spin of the final black hole that forms in this case? We've tried to model through this initial data techniques what we think the black holes should be like initially. And we've tried to model the radiation away. That gives us a chance to try to make an estimate of what the final spin of the black hole is for this configuration of black holes. And by the way, we're assuming that the torque exerted on the individual black holes by their interaction through this process, through spin interactions, is negligible, at least on the timescales that we're interested in. So we're thinking of the spins of the individual black holes as a constant, each of the motion. And so what we find is that, to describe it and try to describe it in simple terms, as we add some spin to the problem by spinning up the initial black holes, we find that roughly half of that spin that we add ends up being retained in the final black hole that's created. And let me show you a plot. In this plot, I have a couple things superposed together. This black curve is the initial angular momentum of the system, and the red curve is the initial orbital part of the angular momentum of the system. And the blue points are the final spin of the black hole, final A over M of the black hole that's formed, that we calculate is formed at the end of the process. We've put a fairly conservative kind of error bars based on assuming that we're not very close with our estimate of when the linearization time is, and these are, at least for the dependence on the numerical simulation and close limit part, these are pretty conservative error bars, we feel. The points are the specific values that we calculate, and they seem to fit quite well to this dotted line, which is a linear fit to the data here, which suggests that as you add spin, you linearly increase the final spin of the black hole that's formed. And if you go ahead and extrapolate this all the way out from A over M 0.2 to A over M of 1, it just begins to be able to form a maximally rotating black hole as you get very near to beginning with maximally rotating black holes. So it agrees with a lot of people's expectations that it's hard to form a maximally rotating black hole by coalescence. So what's next? We'd like to do unequal masses. I haven't got anything to show you on that yet, but we also want to make improvements, and so now I want to go from Lazarus to Lazarus 2, I don't know. And the main thing we want to do is we want to make this numerical simulation bigger, because we've stretched it as far as we can, but we'd really like to have some more. We also want to do a little more with this far limit model. And in particular, we have some data that includes some information from post-Newtonian information about the existing radiation that we'd like to try to study and see if that looks like a good model as well with some radiation information. So let me just say a little bit about where we're going with our improvements. We want to improve numerical simulations. We have a few directions we're pursuing simultaneously. We have a new evolution code. It actually lives in a cactus package, and we call it LASEV. And one of the things that we're interested in trying out, because we're limited by accuracy, we see a lot of limitations just based on the accuracy of the numerical simulation, and we're not able to do a higher number of to do larger simulations. They're already very large. But we're only doing second-order finite differencing techniques, and we feel there's no reason we should be doing that. We want to do higher-order differencing techniques. So we also redesigned this code so it's going to be flexible to change to different systems of evolution equations should anything emerge as a more promising result. And we want to do, again, some of these tests. We said ADM seemed to be the best case, but maybe some of the more stable systems after we have higher-order differencing will prove to be better. Now, we want to be able to approach boundary condition issues, though we're not trying to solve these problems, but we want to be able to respond to any good ideas that emerge, and we want to reduce our restrictions that we have had with our technique so far in having the maximal slicing and vanishing shift to more general gauge conditions. We're also working in collaboration with Jones Group at Goddard to do some Lazarus calculations with adaptive mesh refinement calculations. At Goddard, there's a demonstrated code that can solve Einstein's equations with adaptive mesh refinement, and so far been applied to strong waves, and it's just now beginning to study its behavior with punctures for black holes. And so this is a very promising line of research, and we want to do some work together with these Lazarus modeling techniques and the AMR group at Goddard. We also want to study, like I mentioned, other far limit models, and in particular we're interested in these models that have some radiation content to see if they seem viable. And our goals through all this is to have an overall model with both better fidelity, and if you fix the fidelity, broader applicability to more general problems, as we've been limited so far to these. That's it.
Questions?
Jim.
In your discussion with respect to polarization, are you assuming that the radiation is coming in a perpendicular vertical plane?
Now, the radiation goes out in all directions. It's just circularly polarized. You know, if you think about it, if you're looking at this system, you see the rotation going around in a circle from that angle. If you're looking at it from the equator of the system, it's actually linearly polarized. But it's the same pattern overall that you get from a rotating body, the radiation due to that rotational motion. It is linear in one direction, but it's the configuration of Yeah, it's the polarization configuration that gives you the maximal amount of angular momentum, the maximally efficient angular momentum radiation as compared with the energy. You reach this delta J equals omega times delta E over the azimuthal index M, so in that case.
Thanks.
For sure. It's not obviously perfectly circularly polarized. There's something in the 10 or 20% at least left over there. But that the interpretation physically to me is that, you know, it looks like even though there must be a lot of other things going on, it's still the rotational type motion all the way through that's generating most of the radiation.
Peter?
So I may have missed it, but so there is a relationship between the measured degree of polarization, let's say, and the angular momentum of the individual black holes. Is that right?
No, I don't think.
So you get the same value in the.
They all seem to be polarized comparably the same.
Yeah. I see.
Circular polarized.
So it's all they're
very similar.
The orbital
I mean,
motion. No, there is no coupling to the spin of the individual black holes.
So certainly if one of the spins was in the equatorial plane, or perhaps a little bit off the equatorial plane, then the spin orbit coupling would drive a precessional effect. And a precessional effect would change the polarization with time. But rather than try to, it probably, from my point of view, the best way to understand that would be try to understand it always in the frame of the instantaneous axis of the system, if you could, and then see the precession as an effect of where the observer is relative to that. But that would be a general effect that you have precessing spin, the spin-driven precession.
John, have you guys looked at whether there is a common event horizon at the early stages in these simulations?
What? No, we haven't done any calculations of where event horizons are. So, not for these configurations of black holes. So. I don't expect that in many cases there would be an event horizon this much before the appearance of apparent horizon. It's still possible, but...
There was a paper by Cavani a few months ago where they went back to a binary black hole simulation that was done way a couple of years ago, and although the single black holes apparently were separated by 10M, there was an event horizon formed basically right away. We now backtrack in another way, so it seemed that they were well separated enough. The apparent horizons on each were pretty spherical. There was indeed a very cuspy looking event horizons around both of them.
Yeah, so we haven't calculated event horizons. I can't answer that question. It'd be interesting. I think probably the AEI group is able to do that now if they want to try.
Jeff?
When I look at the picture up there, it looks like the, I don't know how seriously I'm supposed to take the picture, but it looks like the radiation that's coming out is all coming out through in the regime of space-time where the close limit is valid. Is that true? I mean, it's in this green region.
Well, so we have radiation being generated in here as well.
It's being generated in there, but it's passing through.
But our observer that in our calculation, we're seeing the radiation at a point by the point of view of an observer that's even farther out than the boundary, outer boundary of the numerical simulation.
And I understand that, but there's also observers that if they look back at this interior region, would never see the interior region in the close limit. And so these observers would never see their radiation passing through the close limit.
There's
a certain domain of space-time in which a close limit metric is valid, and it's a late time region of space-time above some null cone, and the radiation coming out before that null cone that separates where the close limit is valid in previous regions doesn't seem to be contained in that picture there.
So our close limit is in here. So I'm not completely understanding your question, but right. So radiation is coming out here.
Right.
But so here, radiation coming out here. Back here, that we have no radiation here.
There's an implication in this picture.
We have not modeled the radiation in here. So this is, that's why our waveforms start at zero, because we have no model for the radiation in this part.
I understand that, but there's an implication in this picture that any radiation that comes out of this binary system is going to pass through a region of space-time in which the close limit is valid.
Right.
And I don't believe that's true. That the close limit is not valid at early retarded times.
So it's not any region of the space-time. It's regions that are in the future of this initial data, right?
Well, see, you have the region in which the close limit is valid, sort of implicitly portrayed in this region as the boundary of that between this green line up there as a space-like line. And I'd be more tend to believe that the boundary should be a null line rather than a space-like line.
Right. So in principle, I would say,
we could be
applying close limit calculations out here somewhere, for example.
Well, that's what I'm contending should be true.
We're not doing that though.
The boundary should be an outgoing null line.
The ingoing null line seems more likely
to be. But not space-like necessarily. Yeah. So I think
this boundary is where we apply the close limit approximation. I would venture to say that it could apply quite well to propagating radiation out here, somewhat distant away, thinking of this as a central body, and then we're propagating radiation.
Well, the assumption there is that the close limit is the same thing as the far limit, and I don't think that's really what's meant by the close limit. The far field is not necessarily in the close limit domain of space-time.
It's just for sure curve all the way out on the space-time surface. That's all the close limit is.
Right, but the question is where that region of space-time is valid. Is it a space-like surface or is it a null hypersurface? The physics propagates along the null cone, not along space-like There's no reason it would, I mean, physically you would expect this transition to happen along a null
cone. So I would divide the question of the generation of the radiation from the propagation of the radiation. All the close limit's doing eventually at some late stage is propagating the radiation away. If it's propagating effectively on a background that's a very light curve, I mean, I agree that there might be somewhere, I would say, greater than this domain where close limit type of calculations, because locally the space-time looks quite a bit like Kerr out here far away from this central region, but we're not trying to do that. Somebody might try to make some more mileage and fill in some of this space with something like that. It might be a good idea, which would be to say putting boundary conditions based on perturbation theory on a numerical simulation, but we're not trying to do that.
Do that if this.
Somewhere like that, yeah.
Right. You're out of boundary in the numerical simulation, it's like 100
degrees. No, it's like 35.
35. So it's actually, so your detector is actually inside and it's closer to the
rest. Well, we also cut out part of that before passing it on, but.
Yeah, you will see that empty region affecting the Kosky limit, right?
Right. So if we, you mean if we observe radiation here, right? It's getting unmodeled sources. Yeah, that's true.
Right, and that's also why at 50 nm, you basically see that the Kosky evolution most is in the form. I mean, it's quasi normal radiation, right? If your boundary is if your detector is at 40 nm, you locate.
Well, our observer is a little closer than that, but we see the future of this modeled region. There is some radiation we're seeing that's in the future of this, which we've had to just make up a model, a radiation empty model essentially for this part of the data for the close limit, and we're seeing the future of this. Getting to us around 30, I mean, there's a little bit of an upswing in the peak, and then there's a quasi-normal ring down quite quickly. Because after all, we don't have a very thick region of numerical simulation.
Okay, I think we're going to have to finish this discussion over coffee. Yeah. Let's thank John again.
Thanks.
Let's come back for 20 after. This is a short break.